So what we have here is Jesus telling us, against whatever thing in the world suggests to us, that actually the route to extreme happiness is by way of holiness. Holiness, purity, integrity. Now, these all sound like nice but rather boring things, don't they? But actually, according to Jesus, the result of holiness, the result of these kind of things, is this incredible vision of God himself.
Welcome to the God-Centered Life with Josh Moody. Continuing our study in the Beatitudes, starting at the 8th verse of Matthew chapter 5 today in our Steps of Blessing series. We're calling this one, Want. Josh Moody is senior pastor of College Church in Wheaton. I'm Todd Busty. Thanks for joining us today. Josh, another situation where leaning into a statement brings out its power. Can we say that a vision of God himself can potentially blow past any pursuit of happiness as long as we have a proper vision of God himself?
For sure. We need to be talking about the real God, the true God. And when we have that vision of God, then it is, what could be better? What could be more exciting? What could be more thrilling? And we'll be looking at that today, that vision of God for those who are pure in heart.
I'm thinking of the mercy that we talked about in the last two sessions, right? God's wrath, and really understanding that and the gift that's been given to us puts us in a place where we're able to experience more of the happiness.
Yeah.
Let's get to it. Matthew chapter 5, verse 8. Here's Josh.
Well, we're looking at the Beatitudes. If you turn in your Bibles to Matthew's Gospel, chapter 5, and verse 8. That's what we've got up to in our series in the evening. I don't know whether you've ever been skiing, and I have to confess I haven't been skiing for quite a long time. But the few times I have been, with the generosity of those helping me experience the fun of going skiing, I've had some memorable experiences skiing, I have to say. I remember sliding for what seemed like quite some time on my back underneath the overhead ski lifts, unable to stop, down some wide piste in Switzerland, and sort of smiling and waving at those going overhead, you know. Hi. One time, I was with a real expert, a Swiss skier who had been doing this kind of thing since he was a baby, pretty much. And he took me off, a good friend, he took me off down some black diamond, you know, the black, and it was a sort of mogul run kind of thing. And so I went with him, a willing victim. And only to find, though, to sort of cap it off, that actually even this hair-raising black diamond mogul run had been blocked off by some avalanche that they feared was about to happen. And there was a rather helpful-looking arrow pointing down what to me looked like the side of a house, you know, an equivalent in terms of its steepness. And that was obviously where we meant to go. So he looked at me and said, "You've got to lean into it and jump forward." I was like, "Okay, thank you." And so off he went, you know, zip, 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 zip. And sort of got to the bottom of this house. And then it was my turn. And I duly jumped and turned and, you guessed it, slid on my back until it plateaued out at the bottom. Snowboarding is even more of an extreme sport, I guess, isn't it? And I've never done that. I don't know if anyone here has done snowboarding. Sounds like it's a lot of fun. Or there's jet skiing and water skiing and who knows what. I guess if you really want to be cool and you have the cash to burn, you could go helicopter skiing, I guess, where you're transported, aren't you, up to some virgin snow high on the mountains. And you better be pretty good because there's no one else around to rescue you if you do happen to slide on your back. All this to say that Christianity seems the very opposite of an extreme sport, doesn't it? Christianity is what you do when you want to feel safe, isn't it? Secure and stable. It's a crutch, is it not? But the Beatitude we're looking at this evening tells us that there is an extreme, edgy, gloriously happy side to the Christian faith. After all, have you ever thought what it would mean to, as Jesus says, see God. Woe to me, I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. As Isaiah, the prophet, said. And so we're not talking checkers here, are we, in terms of sports? This is off-piste skiing. This is dangerous stuff. You cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live, as the Lord said to Moses. Now, what we're talking about here is only possible because of what has happened before the Beatitudes. What's happened before in the Beatitudes? These Beatitudes as a whole are building up by God's grace, his initiative to save us without anything we have done, so that we are filled with righteousness, verse 6. See? And after that experience of being saved, come these characteristics of the Christian life, what it means to live as a saved person. And part of what it means to be a Christian, then, is this promise of extraordinary access to the presence of God. God is spirit. He cannot be seen with physical eyes in any sense that we can compute. But the point is that God is holy. Woe is me, if I've seen the Lord Almighty and I have a man of unclean lips. The point is the Lord is holy, and no human in our sinfulness can see him, can experience him, can enjoy him, can have this, well, as I say, sort of extreme sport kind of encounter with God. Without death, no one can see me and live, the Lord said to Moses. But because of the blessing of Christ, through him, through Jesus, and in him, we can. We can have this extraordinary spiritual experience, this blessing whereby we are called to see God. So what we have here is Jesus telling us, against what everything in the world suggests to us, that actually the route to extreme happiness is by way of holiness. Holiness, purity, integrity. Now, these all sound like nice, but rather boring things, don't they? But actually, according to Jesus, the result of holiness, the result of these kind of things, is this incredible vision of God himself. Who, if he is real and true, well, surely God is the most dynamic and powerful and exhilarating experience any person could ever have, right? And so this beatitude, this blessing, this happiness is that we see God by means of a pure heart. Let's look then at what it means to see God and then what it means to be pure in heart. What the blessing is first, and then how we are told that we can go about achieving that blessing.
As Josh just said, we'll look at the blessing followed by how to get it in just a moment. But first, a quick reminder that during this month, we're offering up a fantastic book from Tim Keller. It's called Hidden Christmas. We'd love to send it your way and enrich your holiday season by doing so. Stop by our website, GodCenteredLife.org, for more information. Back into the book of Matthew. Here's Josh.
So what does it mean to see God? Well, it is the eye of faith. The person who can see God is the person who can see him at work in the world, isn't he? She. That's what it means to see God. Some people look at the world, and for them, God is such a stranger, as someone once said to me about their experience of life. God is such a stranger. That's how some people look at the world. For them, there is no evidence of God in the world for them at all. It is all, as the poet put it, red in tooth and claw. It is vicious, angry. There's no sense of God. It's brutal. Where could there be such a good God in all this mess and chaos and war? What's more, for many people, the world and what happens in the world appears random. Now, I'm not talking about scientific technicalities here when I talk about things being random or by chance. It goes beyond that. In any modern university that I've ever been associated with or a part of or known people a part of, actually, the science department has had more believers in God than the literature or philosophical departments. We don't think that's the case, but that really is the case. This is not about the technical details, then, of the world or nature and things like that. This is about the vision, the perspective, the way you look at it, the way you put the details together. So the person who sees God in the world. But the person who sees God also sees God in history, in their own personal lives and in the lives of nations and of the whole world, where someone sees the story of great men, and another sees the story of industrial forces or economic factors influencing the direction of world history or their personal lives or where someone's born becomes what they are. Someone sees these kind of things. The person who sees God sees history, as it's often been said, as his story. The story of God and his works. Now, mediated and channeled through all these different secondary causes, no doubt, of course. But in the end, this person sees the hand of God everywhere. You see him raising up this empire, shutting down this one, causing all things to work together for the good of those who love God. So there's that, but it's even more than that. For those are both rather intellectual, aren't they? Seeing God in the world and seeing God in history. And the person who sees God goes beyond that kind of intellectual realm. He or she has the eye of faith, as it were. I think one of the most wonderful passages in the Bible that talks about this is in Hebrews chapter 11, where it talks about Moses, who we are told, Moses chose to leave the riches of Egypt because Moses saw him who is invisible. The eye of faith, and that roll call of the heroes of faith. He saw him who is invisible. And so there is this personal, spiritual, transcendent vision, a real sense, a sight, an encounter. Which means that even something so enticing for Moses as being a prince of Egypt, and with all that goes with that, the greatest power in the day, at the greatest court of the day, with all the luxury that money could buy, that for him, and for those who see with the eye of faith, that is nothing, because it will pass away. And there is a reward for the people of faith to come. And all this comes out of seeing Christ and knowing him personally. Seeing Christ, as Moses, we are told, did, and knowing him personally. So this is the great thing that Christians now can have. You and I, who believe in Jesus. Christians are not only those who notionally believe, that is, theoretically believe, or nominally believe, notionally, as the old Puritans used to put it. But they are those who experimentally believe, as the Puritans put it, or experientially, or vitally, or actually believe. They see God. Now, the world laughs, of course. Seems crazy. But for the Christian, there is more than simply the five senses. There is a mystical, if you like, and I don't know whether you like that word or not, or better, and perhaps personal, relational, and that's a rather overused word, isn't it, these days, but an encounter with God, who walks with us, who we know, who we, to use Jesus' word, see. And so we don't just see him at work in things, we see him himself. You know, this has actually always been true of those who have known God. If you read the Psalms, sort of God's hymn book, as it were, if you read the Psalms, you'll come across frequently this idea of a sense of God. Psalm 73, actually, you could look at that at home if you like afterwards. Psalm 73 is almost a commentary on this beatitude here, in fact. As so often with Jesus' teaching, you can almost hear the reflection on the Psalms breathing through his words. You get a sense that Jesus spent a lot of time in the Psalms, I think. And here it's a reflection of the fact that Psalm 73, that there's so many wicked people seem to do well. That's what that psalm talks about. And the psalmist says, what is there who keep their heart pure? What's there for those guys who keep their heart pure? And the psalmist, you see, is struggling with that idea. This feeling that we have, don't we, of what a waste of time, as it were, we might say it is, to be a Christian, you know? Or to follow God. you don't get anything out of it. And those who don't follow God and are wicked and wrong seem to get a lot of good stuff, don't they? Well, then the psalmist sees God. Yet I am always with you, he realizes. You guide me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel. And afterwards you will take me into glory. Whom have I in heaven but you? And being with you, I desire nothing on earth. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion, that is my share, my reward forever. That's all seeing God. Now, the world wouldn't see any of it, but we do, those who have the eyes of faith. It's not make-believe, is it? It's not pretense. It's not a figment of the imagination. It's real, and it's a kind of seeing, a kind of sensing. Not just with one of the five senses, as it were, but some sort of extra perspective given by God. So that all those faculties see God at work in this physical world, interpret things those ways, have their eyes opened, and no longer blinded by the God of this world, as Paul put it. And there's an additional now controlling reality that we know that God is with us, even in our darkest days. He guides, he counsels, and afterwards he will take us up into glory. That's what it means to see God, and it's wonderful beyond comparison. And even that, of course, is going to be surpassed by something even better. The beatific vision, as they used to call it, the more dynamic yet encounter with God in heaven. The Apostle Paul describes it as when we are away from the body, we are at home with the Lord. And he says, now we see but a poor reflection. Now we see but a poor reflection. So we see now, but it's a poor reflection, as through a mirror darkly, as it were. Now we see a poor reflection. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And how have you put those things together? Paul's talking about something very profound, isn't he? Amazing. Extreme. Fantastic. Yet real now. And even more real to come in heaven and in glory. Now, of course, at this time of year, this is a very important thought, isn't it? See him lying on a bed of straw, a droughty stable with an open door. The Prince of Glory is his name. The baby, not just a baby. A man, not just gentle, but strong, dying that we might live. But all this seasonal festivity, and in the center a baby, a person who we need to see as God. And of course, that's actually the subtext, I think, of what Jesus is saying even here to these disciples and these crowds. There he is, you see. I mean, can you kind of get back into the zone, as it were? Imagine yourself there. There he is. You know, can you see him? Sitting there, where he sat down to teach in the ancient custom of the world, as a teacher would sit down then, sitting down, delivering the message, and he looks at them with a sort of twinkle in his eye, I suppose, perhaps fanciful, but you know, bear with me, and says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. And of course, what's he saying? Who is it who's speaking those words? Who are they looking at as he delivers them at that time? Jesus, God himself, who they see. And if they have a pure heart, if they have the eyes to really see, they will see him as he really is, God incarnate, seated before them. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Which moves us to the next part of the Beatitude. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Well, what does it mean to be pure in heart, and how do I get it? This is such a wonderful thing. You see, I suppose there are no people who have ever existed who wish to spend eternity separate from God. And so then, how do I see him? How do I ensure that I do see him face to face? Once we realize that this seeing God is so amazing and is open to us now as a possibility of experience, if more fully fulfilled later, yet we may pray for the eyes of our heart, as Paul put it, to be enlightened, that we may know the hope to which he has called us, his incomparably great power to us believe, and all that kind of stuff that's there. And then, of course, well, how do we get it? And it is, Jesus says, by being pure in heart. Again, Psalm 73 is a great commentary on what Jesus means here. It helps us understand what he's saying. Is Jesus, people have wondered, talking about inner purity or moral intentionality, not just what I do, but what I want to do as well? Or is Jesus talking about integrity? This phrase, pure in heart. Is he talking about this integrity, that I may live life as an open book, never one person one place and another another place? And different people have said one or the other, those twos. And of course, I think the answer is really both. They're both interwoven together, aren't they? To be pure in that sense and have that moral intentionality inside, and to be have integrity. They kind of both interweave together, don't they? But the focus, though I think both those things are true, the focus, I think, is actually elsewhere. Or it's both those together for a particular purpose. Jesus, I think, is answering the question that Psalm 73 and the psalmist there was raising, which is, why bother? Why go through all this? What does it get for me, this stuff? And almost all the Beatitudes are in some sense about that, aren't they? The poor in spirit. Not much hope for them, is there? The meek. They're not going to get anything, are they? The hungering and thirsting. Poor guys, don't want to be one of them. The being persecuted. I mean, who wants to be one of those, right? None of these things seem the sort of thing that we choose to have for fun, are they, right? So why do we bother? Why do we sign up for this stuff? What's the purpose? And of course, you and I, we ask ourselves these questions at times, don't we? And it's good to be honest about it. So the psalmist says, surely in vain have I kept my heart pure. In vain have I washed my hands in innocence. All day long I have been plagued. I have been punished every morning. A little bit of a depression coming through there, perhaps. So why, though? Why follow God? Why go to all the work to have this pure heart?
That's Josh Moody, and this is The God-Centered Life. We're going to pause there for a moment and perhaps encourage you to wrestle with that question. Why go to all the work to have this pure heart? Josh is going to tackle that when we get together next time. In the meantime, Psalm 73, packing in a punch here, Josh. Why bother? And then you tie that question to the Beatitudes. And, you know, on the calendar, we're moving closer to celebrating meekness and lowly estate and a king coming to a small town, and he's announced only to foreigners. It's kind of this broken to be fixed, the irony of the gospel showing up here, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the why go to all the bother is because you get to see God, the purity of heart. So in the gospel, we need to be those who are in need to in order to receive grace and mercy. And having received grace and mercy, to have intimacy with God, it's connected to our purity, our holiness. The Bible says, without holiness, no one will see God. And here, Jesus saying, blessed are those who are pure in heart, for they will see God. So the reason for, and we'll look at this more as we get into it next time, but the motivating power is not simply moralistic. It's an encounter and intimacy with God himself.
Hmm. And we'll look forward to digging further into that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Josh. Have you ever thought about what might have occurred to Joseph when his friends found out his fiancée was pregnant? They're either hitting him up with, either you're lying to us or she's lying to you. Which is it? Followed by Joseph attempting to explain the Holy Spirit, which may have brought about less than friendly reactions. See, this is not a distant story. That kind of dynamic exists today. There are parallels to our world throughout the Christmas narrative, and Tim Keller does a fantastic job of drawing those two worlds together, 2,000 years ago and what's going on today. It's in a book called Hidden Christmas, and we'd love to send it your way. Simply swing by our website. We've got a year-end goal in mind. If you can help us with that, a gift of any amount, we'll say thank you by sending you Tim Keller's book, Hidden Christmas. That website again, godcenteredlife.org. Next time we get together, how to be a Pharisee.
You see, the reason I think why Pharisaism of one kind or another is always popular is because it's possible. I can follow this rule or that. I can clean the outside of the dish, but I can't clean the inside.
We'll wrap up our look at the Beatitudes when we get together next time. GodCenteredLife.org resources for you and the Tim Keller book. And this is your invitation to join us for the next edition of The God-Centered Life with Josh Moody.